room my whole night. I was ready to jump over there. Say, my name's Russell Spatz, I'm a recovered alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 25th, 1981. I'm a member of the Power Tables Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Russell, why don't you start reading?
You did that better than me. Where are we?
I don't know. That's why I did it.
Anybody remember where we left off?
XXVI.
Oh, we read, that's right. She's right. You're right. That's very good. We read the letter.
Oh, right here. Right here.
You may rely absolutely on anything they say about themselves.
Right.
Okay. The physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcohol torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent, with some of us, but we are sure that our bodies are sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. You feel like saying anything about that?
I'm enjoying this.
The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little, but as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. Though we work out our solution on the spiritual as well as an altruistic plane, we favor hospitalization for the alcoholic who is very jittery or defogged. More often than not, it is imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached, as he has then a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. The doctor writes, "The subject presented in this book seems to me to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. To say this after many years of experience as medical director of one of the oldest hospitals in the country, treating alcoholic and drug addiction. There was, therefore, a sense of real satisfaction when I was asked to contribute a few words on the subject, which is covered in such masterly detail in these pages. We doctors have realized for a long time that some form of moral psychology was of urgent importance to alcoholics, but its application presented difficulties beyond our conception. What with our ultra-modern standards, our scientific approach to everything, we are perhaps not well equipped to apply the powers of good that lie outside our synthetic knowledge." Actually, we had gone over this, the powers of good, but moving on. Many years ago, one of the leading... Yes, we did. Powers of good, powers of God, take out the O, that was the...
So who's that young lady?
Yeah, she was close enough. Close enough for government work.
I think we finished that chapter.
We finished this. We actually may have finished the chapter. I'm not sure. We finished the chapter?
No.
Fraud the emotional?
Fraud.
Okay. Let's start with the fraudy.
Frothy
emotional appeal seldom suffice. Oh, we did do that, the frothy. I remember. You had questions on the frothy. Yeah, somebody asked you, what does that mean? You say, you're killing your father. You're killing, don't you remember that whole deal?
I remember speaking.
Okay, let's skip in after that. If any feel that as psychiatrists directing a hospital for alcoholics, we appear somewhat sentimental, let them stand with us a while on the firing line, see the tragedies, the despairing wives, the little children, let the solving of these problems become a part of their daily work and even of their sleeping moments, and the most cynical will not wonder that we have accepted and encouraged this movement. We feel after many years of experience that we have found nothing which has contributed more to the rehabilitation of these men than the altruistic movement now growing up among them.
Now, let's stop right there.
Okay.
Let you take a breath. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. My name's Paul Lee.
Hey, Paul.
It's a privilege and a blessing to be here tonight. And if anybody's new or coming back, welcome home. You're off the hook, and that's the message that we have here. You are off the hook? I don't care what's going on. You don't pick up a drink or a drug and you're off the hook. This I mean, I don't know if we read it last week, that's why it seems familiar, or if I read it 20 years ago, but it is the most powerful thing. I mean, if you just think about this, okay, and the enormity of this will never, thank God, stop on me, or it hasn't ceased to amaze me in the whole time I'm sober. And that's just, well, what the whole thing's about, but here it says, if any feel that as psychiatrists directing a hospital, we appear somewhat sentimental, let them stay with us on the fighting lines to find, there was no cure for alcoholism. There was no answer. They didn't know what to do with people like you. Not me, but people like you. And, I mean, just think about it. You got 100 people here. And you're all shit-faced, because that's why you're there. And you're in a hospital. And they have no idea what to do with you. So all of a sudden, this group started with two guys, and that's the enormity for me, that then when this book was written, there were 100 people. And there were a group of 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And the purpose of this book is to show the reader precisely how we have recovered. Now this guy, this Dr. Silkworth, I don't need to introduce you, do I? This isn't a hold'em game. They're all in. Come on. I got this. Don't worry about it. It's a game of 10. So the key is that, and we read it last week. We ended the meeting, or we said in the middle of the meeting that it said, and you can thoroughly rely on anything these men say about themselves. This was Dr. Silkworth, a very pronounced, a world-recognized psychiatrist. And he wrote this letter that we're reading now, the doctor's opinion, after reading the manuscript of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous that Bill Wilson had written with the help of God. And he read it. He realized that, wow, there may be an answer for this previously unanswerable situation. In 1939, there was no answer to the alcoholic degenerate. They threw him in a state hospital, let him rot away. They gave him shock treatments, or they just locked him up, or he was a town drunk, and everybody would walk over him. That was the only answer. And today, even though not everybody grabs onto this, and not everybody seizes this with the desperation or fervor that only the dying can realize, the answer is here. Today they finally have an answer to how to keep us from needing to see Dr. Silkworth and his relatives. Because now we've found an answer. It's called 12 Steps. And it's written in this book that tells us how we can become responsible and productive members of society. And in 1939, there were 100 people. To me, that is, I mean, if it's not overwhelming to you, maybe I did too many drugs or you didn't do enough. But to me, it's a freaking overwhelming statement. That now when you realize there are thousands of meetings around the country, right now, around the world, with this many or more people in it, and there were 100 in 1939. I find that overwhelming. Evidently, nobody else does. So I'm going to pass it. I'm going to say a prayer.
I'm going to read on. Coming up to one of my favorite parts. Men and women, now I know you guys won't identify with this. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. I don't know why you drank. I drank for the effect. The sensation was so elusive. As a matter of fact, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, most of my buddies say, we didn't think you drank a lot. It's just that you drank so fast. I was a fast drinker. I didn't want to wait around to get to that place, that spot. I wanted to get there immediately. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And that is a profound statement for me on many levels. I know we're talking about the drinking now. Your alcoholic life seems the only normal one because it says later on that our real problem centers in our mind, not our body. And we all know, if you're sitting here, that Well, I think most of you guys look like you're sober, and I've been sober for a long time. Some of you guys have been sober for a time, and you soon realize after you've been sober for a month or two or three that the drinking is the symptom of the disease, that you're actually crazy. I mean, somewhere along the line, and I think we've mentioned this before, if you're an alcoholic, after your 17th or 20th meeting or your third month in sobriety, and you've had to deal with your mind sober without the alcohol, you start realizing that you've got some serious problems that have to do with alcohol that have nothing to do with drinking. Just some serious craziness going on. So what I have to understand, and which is, and this is the serious problem, is that my alcoholic life, and by my alcoholic life, I'm not just talking about getting drunk. Because most of the people I hurt, most of the crap I caused, most of the problems I made for myself, you know, most of the mistakes I made, most of the misjudgments I made them stone cold sober. You know, I wish I could say that all the people I hurt, all the hearts I ripped out, all the irresponsible decisions I made, all the people I let down, all the times I screwed up, I wish I could say it's alcohol's fault. It's not my fault. But, you know, the bottom line is most of the people I hurt, I've hurt cold stone sober. I've hurt many of the same people, many of the same ways after I came into Alcoholics Anonymous when I stopped drinking. You know, it's not alcohol's fault, it's alcoholism. I suffer from alcohol. Hey, listen, if alcohol is your problem, I got a solution for you. You ready for this? I'm going to save you a lot of money. Stop drinking. Stop drinking, have a great life. But if you have the disease I have goes on even after you stop drinking. It's called alcoholism. And one of the problems with the disease has to do with my thinking and my perceptions. And this isn't a new thing, you know. Every speaker, every person who's involved in this understands it's the way we perceive things, you know, the way we feel. You know, I take things personally. I'm sensitive. You know, as my sponsors say, you're not sensitive, you're touchy. You know, everything has to do with me. That's the deal with me. And that's the real problem. The problem is I know of no other way of reacting. To me, every way I react, every anger I have, every feeling I have seems absolutely, when they say you're absolute, the alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Every horrible feeling, everything I do, every reaction I have, no matter how crazy it is, seems absolutely normal. And if I'm not doing it, my buddies are doing the same thing. If I didn't screw up last week or do something, and the guys I hang out with, if I tell them some of the crap I do, you know what they say? They say, man, I do the same thing. And in my way of thinking, there's only one way to react, there's only one way to think, there's only one way to believe. And that's part of this, that's why I love this part. It says, to them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. What I have to understand is my alcoholic way of doing things, my alcoholic way of thinking, it's like, being an alcoholic is like being right-handed. You know, I'm right-handed. I don't know how many people, some people right-handed, some people left. It feels comfortable to me to use my right hand. I do everything with my right hand. I'll shake with my right hand. This feels comfortable to me. You tell me, listen, you know what your problem is, Russ? Your life would be wonderful if you would just always use your left hand. I say, you're crazy. You're nuts. You know, this is the way I do it. I do it with Murray. He says, you do your left hand, everything's going to go well for you. So for whatever crazy reason, something happens in my life, I decide to try it. So I start losing my left hand. All of a sudden, there's money that appears in the bank. You know, women are attracted to me. My world turns, and all of a sudden I start saying, this is the greatest thing in the world. If I only knew about the left hand, I'm never going to stop using my left hand. This is the greatest thing in the world. And you know what the only problem is? The only problem is that 3 years later, I'm using my left hand, everything's okay. Somebody puts out their hand, and I go like this. Because the problem is, this is my problem is my natural way of doing things, my natural way of thinking, my natural way of blaming other people for my problems. Or when I'm upset, you know, our spiritual axiom is whenever I'm disturbed, no matter what is wrong, there's something wrong with me. My natural way of thinking is whenever I'm disturbed, no matter what the problem, there's something wrong with you. There's something wrong with the world. And so this line here, and this is something I have to realize, that my way of thinking that I value so much, that I think I'm so smart and so brilliant, my way of thinking seems normal to me. Crazy thinking to me is normal. The way they want me to think in here, the way they want me to act in here, I think it's absolutely BS. It seems abnormal to me. So, I don't know if you want to say anything about that. No?
No, I could expound in part, to elaborate is the word I would. And clarify was really.
Okay.
I was trying to figure out how to gently let you know where I was going with this. You know, the part here is, did we speak about the phenomenon of craving just now?
It's coming up. It's coming up.
I'll wait to share.
Okay.
They
are restless, irritable. Craving's coming up. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass to the well-known stages of spree, emerging resentful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over, unless the person can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of his recovery. So, craving.
Thank you. Well, not only a psychic change, but prior to that, Ray Allen, who was my sponsor for many years, used to always say that physical good health is the number one enemy of the alcoholic. And it took me a long time to even understand what he meant, but I'm going to put it out here and just think about it. You go to a rehab or you're in a halfway house, or you get sober for X period of time. No matter how bad you were drinking and using out there, you put together 6, 8, 10, 12 days, you are a new person. I mean, it's just the way it is, I promise you. I know at 2 weeks, I won't even use the word sober, but at 2 weeks, without putting a chemical in my body, I could have almost said, well, that must have all been a mistake those 15 years. I am on top of my game. Holy good God, I slept last night. I have a few dollars in my pocket. This is incredible. Let me go out and conquer the world. And once that happens, that physical good health has made me in a very short time forget this stuff here, especially if I'm brand new, and I'm back out on that. And then it talks about this phenomenon of craving. The reason I'm going to speak about this a little bit longer than I normally do, Russell, is because something happened tonight that was sort of right up here, and I didn't even know if I was going to go here, but I'm going. I smoked 3 packs a day my entire life. And I've never even said this story too much publicly, because I always hated speakers at a meeting that I was at, as I'm smoking 3 packs a day, and they're saying, well, if you're not giving up cigarettes, you're not, so I'm not going there, trust me. Matter of fact, I would love to have a cigarette right now. So that's not where I'm going. But up until 5.5 years ago, I smoked cigarettes, 3 packs a day, every day, since I was 15. And I tried everything known to man since I was sober, and God. I prayed, I did hypnosis, I did patches, I did Nicorettes, I did punching the filter so you get less, breaking the cigarette, anything that ever came out, Zyban, Eban, Cuban, anything that ever came out, I was the first on the list to try it. That's how much of the bottom I was at in cigarettes, and nothing ever worked. 5.5 years ago, I was in Long Island, and I wake up in the morning and I was like oozy and woozy. They take me to the hospital, in Southampton Hospital, and they thought I might have had a stroke. They didn't know what it was, but they put me on the stroke heart attack floor. And they hooked me up to all of these things, and my wife's up there. And this doctor, thank God, he had less of a personality than anyone I ever met. You talk about bedside personality, this guy had a graveside personality. Because this is what happened. He walked into my room with my wife sitting right there, and he's looking at my charts, and they're thinking something with my head happened. So they're ordering brain scans, head scans, neuro scans, and all for the next morning. And as he's sitting there, he looks at me and he says, and you smoke, right? I said, yeah, I smoke a lot. So 3 packs a day, my whole life. He says, you know what? As he's walking out of the room, he turns around. He says, you know what? I'm going to also order a lung scan. In addition to all of these brain things, I'm ordering a lung scan. This is, as he's walking out of the room, I'm telling you this story, I can see myself right back in that bed. He's walking out of the room, and he turns around. I said, well, doctor, Why would you be ordering a lung scan? You said this is all about something in the head. He says, it's very possible that you had a lung tumor, cancer in your head that went to your brain. So I want to check your lungs. And he walked out of the room. My wife said to me subsequently, she never saw me that white in my entire life. Here I am, I'm in a hospital bed, and the guy said, well, there's a probability that you have lung cancer, but it became brain cancer, so good luck. And he left the freaking room. The next morning, I've had MRIs before, you know, when you're in clothes. So, you know, you go for your knees, for different things. And you always say a prayer. I'd say different prayers that I remember. I'll either recite how it works to myself, or prayer of St. Francis, or, you know, say things to God, right? Now, this time they're doing all these tests, but now I'm really freaked out about this lung cancer and this brain cancer. But I know that I can't stop smoking because I've tried everything. As I'm going into the tube, I said my prayers, and I ran out of prayers, and I said, now look, God, here's what I'll do. I will try. I don't suggest this, by the way, making deals with God, but this is something that, this is the way it happened. I said, God, I will try. I will try not to buy a pack of cigarettes from this day forward. You're going to have to do everything else. As I'm sitting here, that was August, it'll be 6 years this August, I never picked up a cigarette from the time I came through that tube. Now, I told you I couldn't do that. I couldn't. My wife, actually, who didn't see me get sober, heard the power, heard everything that happened to me when I got sober without asking, and how dramatic it was. But here, she said she was there. She said she knows how impossible. She knows that I burned all the couches and all the cars, and every car was full of cigarettes. And she would say, how could you do that in our house? I said, it was my cigarettes. What do you mean how I could do that in your house? I mean, that's why I don't care about you when I'm me. And sadly, just like what Russell said, we can get to it later. But so that's my point. And then I was with Louie tonight, and that's what kicked it up. Louie stopped smoking for 17 years. And then 17 years ago, is that right? 17 years ago, of course, of whatever was going on, picked up one cigarette. Now, Louis sober 31 years. We were talking about tonight, that's what kicked this up. Picked up one cigarette, had spent the last 17 years with the phenomenon of craving, not being able to get back the gift that was given 17 years ago. And that's what happens to so many of us with booze and drugs. Just substitute the situation, okay? Because I've seen it happen to so many people. And, you know, I love it, right? So maybe this is the time. Like that website, ourtime.com for old people. This is our time.
Well, you're on that. Oh, I want to pick up on the on that, segue into the gift, what you were talking about when you said the gift. Because this next paragraph is incredible and very important. It talks about that. Is this a closed meeting or an open meeting?
Open.
Okay, well, are there any alcoholics? How many people are alcoholics here? Please raise your, okay. Let me make sure we got the same deal going on. Did you ever have a time in your life where you had a drinking problem? I'm the only one? Okay. You ever have a problem that you had such a bad drinking problem that you actually tried to stop drinking, you tried to control your drinking?
Yeah.
Okay, so far you and I got the same thing going on. You ever have a time in your life you tried a bunch of times to control your drinking and it failed, you weren't able to do it? Did any, were any of you guys like me, you couldn't, anybody ever get to a point where you couldn't stop drinking? Okay. And it wasn't because you didn't want to stop drinking. Anybody here actually wanted to stop drinking, but you couldn't stop drinking?
Yeah.
Okay. And anybody here ever get to the point, like I got to the point where you gave up trying to stop drinking because there was no hope because you couldn't stop drinking? Okay. But you're not drinking. What happened? Now here's the deal. You don't have a flipping clue. Now, I know what happened, and the only reason I know what happened is because I accept axiomatically that God and outside power did it for me. See, I accept that. If you don't accept that, then you don't have a flipping clue. Now, that's what we're about to talk about. We're about to talk about this. Everybody who comes, every single person that comes into Alcoholics Anonymous has the same problem, and every single person, I believe, based on what I've seen, is given the gift. Is given the gift. So then you say, well, if that's true, how come people drink again? How come people smoke again? And that's what this paragraph is going to talk about. And I'm actually going to skip ahead one thing for something else the doctor says later on. Here's what he says. On the other hand, he just got done talking about the craving. On the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change, and that's as close as he gets to defining this. You know, he's a doctor. He's not a theologian. He's not going to talk about the God thing, but he's going to hint about it. Once a psychic change has occurred, the very same people, by the way, he's talking about you guys, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol. That's you. That's me. Now, what does he mean by that psychic change? Later on in the book, it says this. This is Dr. Young. The doctor said, you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. By the way, he's talking about you. He's talking about me. I've never seen one single case recover where that state of mind existed to the extent it does in you. Our friend felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him. This is on page 27. He said to the doctor, is there no exception? He doesn't use the word psychic change, he uses a different word. He says, yes, replied the doctor. There is. Exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. He's talking about the same thing as the psychic change, and it's in the same book. To me, these occurrences are phenomena, which is code, scientific code for miracle. Can't explain it. It's just something that happens. We don't have any explanation. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements or rearrangements, ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. In fact, I've been trying to produce some such emotional rearrangement within you. With many individuals, the methods which I employed are successful, but I have never been successful with an alcoholic of your description. He's talking about something happened. It can't be described scientifically. You want to know something? If you're like me, you don't even know when it happened. All you know is one day you could, this is what you know. This is what I know. It's just sort of like in the Bible, they say, I don't know, I was blind, but now I see. I have no idea. All I know is one day I couldn't stop drinking. I tried, I couldn't stop. There was nothing I could do. I was proud to stop drinking. And then one day it was lifted from me and I found that I could stop drinking. I wasn't drinking. And if they say, well, when did this happen? The answer is, I don't have a flipping clue. I went to a meeting, I picked up a white chip, I don't know, I don't know. Now here's where it goes, so what's the problem? That we should be able to go out, and here's what it says, here's where it gets, what's the basic, does anybody know what the chief characteristic of the alcoholic is according to our 12 and 12? The chief characteristic of everybody in this room?
Defiance.
Here's what it says, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol. The only effort necessary, here comes the good part, is being that required to follow a few simple rules. Probably the only time you'll hear the word rule in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, here's where you see that this guy who wrote this is obviously not an alcoholic. Because if you're an alcoholic, you know there ain't no such thing as a few simple rules. You understand? Well, that's the problem. The problem is
take the rules and shove them. I ain't going to follow the few simple rules for the rest of my life, or even one day, I'm not going to follow. And the truth of the matter is, as you go through this AA thing we're going through, you ultimately discover that when people do fail, and they do drink, or they go sideways, or take the exit off, isn't it always because they stop continuing? They stop following the rules? Because there are sort of rules in here, aren't there? I mean, we don't call them rules, right? We call them steps. We call them a lot of things. We call them principles. We call them attitudes. We call them a lot of stuff, but they're really basically rules for how you live your life from now on, right? And when we slip, even though we're given the gift, before we had no power whatsoever. We were powerless over alcohol. Then we're given the gift, and now we have the power really to make true decisions. You know, when I left my wife, I said, man, I'm free to go to the bars now. I was never free not to go to the bars. Now I'm free not to go to the bars. And now the question is, are we going to follow those rules? And that's why I love this fight. It says the only effort necessary is to follow a few simple rules. Every guy I sponsor, everybody I've known who has gone out, they just can't follow the rules. They can do it for a day or two or three a week, but then it's all of a sudden something happens and they're off.
You know what, Russell? You know I love you, right?
Yeah.
A lot.
Yes, I do that.
You also can't follow the rules because we're in the doctor's opinion. You're sending these people to page 27 to get it, yes, a plug for what you think about 27.
Well, you know.
Anyway, the bottom line.
Paul, consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds.
You're right, thank God. Right. There are a couple of tiny little minds right at the table. Anyway, the part here is that if you go down, I don't know which of these paragraphs we read or didn't, I have a great memory, just a very short one, where it says in the doctor's opinion, which is what we're doing, men have cried out to me in sincere and despairing appeal, doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. Is that one of my ex-wives? What? Doctor, I cannot go on like this. I have everything to live for. I must stop. But I cannot. You must help me. So figure out, now here, look, faced with this problem, if a doctor is honest with himself, he must sometimes feel his own inadequacy. And doctors are taught to believe they're as close to God as anyone. Doctors and lawyers, from what I understand, are the toughest people to show or convince they're powerless. Because everybody's coming to them as if they are the answer person. When you're facing life in prison, that lawyer is your higher power. I mean, whatever he's going to, I don't like, where are all these people going? What place do you live? That's right. Lock these doors, Peter, next week. I mean, I'm an old guy. If I could sit for an hour, I mean, I need a bottle, but I sit. Anyway, so the a lawyer, no, historically, I didn't even invent this. Lawyers, and Russell even invent this, lawyers are very difficult to get sober and stay sober. They have special programs for them called lawyers' assistance programs. Why? Because they're at a place that they think, I don't have anything against lawyers, they saved my life a million times. But my point is, anytime you're going to see a lawyer, he's on the higher power side, and you're on the begging for help side. That is where he has established himself, and sadly, alcoholic and drug addicted lawyers really start to believe that press release. So it's much more difficult to get through to them. That's why when you have someone like Russell that really comes from that place and is still so teachable and real and everything else, it's a phenomenon that only a power greater than ourselves could have done. And there's no question about it. I mean, for a mental patient, you know, my thing was Creedmoor State Hospital. It wasn't that tough to show me, well, you better listen to someone. But him, he had plaques and diplomas and an office. I mean, really. I had a cell. I had bars. So it's a little different, the belief system. And why did I go there? Because it's, doctors are the same way. Doctors the same exact way. How many people have ever had like a real terrible illness other than alcoholism, where they were really afraid? How come everybody raises their hand when Russell asks a question? What is this, like a paid group here? I saw you guys there in the corner, their hands pop up. Work with me. How many people have ever been to a doctor very scared about what was going to happen?
Dude,
thank you. Thank you. I mean, John, really, come on, help me. What's going on? You like these people following from my acting? Give me a break. Well, the bottom line is, at that moment in time, that doctor is your God. At that moment in time, you're there. What is it, Doc? Well, I don't really like the way it looks. Doc, what is it? And he is here, and you are here. Ergo, I love that word, ergo. It's almost like airhead, but ergo. E-R-G-O. Ergo. When a doctor hits that bottom, it is so difficult for him to come and come to believe, which is the prerequisite of getting and staying sober, because his belief level has always been his diploma and the people walking into his office. That's why there are special meetings for doctors, because they have a different issue other than just the burnout. I've buried anesthesiologists, oral surgeons, because they're too freaking smart for this thing. That's why where it says here, the doctor is so overwhelmed. And as Russell said, he saw in front of him, as it says in different parts of this book, a wholesale miracle that has turned into this room tonight that started back with those few people way back then. And the first person that became the friend that helped push this movement to the next level were these doctors that came out of the closet and said, hey, you know what? I wasn't able to do anything with these people no matter what I tried. And all of a sudden, something's happening. So I'm really starting to come to believe on some level that something's happening. He never really said that he's believing, but he sees something happening. And to me, that is just as overwhelming as any of the other stuff. You know, one of the things I've lived on for my entire sobriety is the word wow. I still get wowed. I mean, every day, something happens that wows me. Okay? And I hope to God that continues. Because if I stop getting wowed, I don't show up too much. And the last thing I'm going to say, at least for this go-round, is, and Russell said it, you know, my first sponsor, Joe, said to me so often, he said, Paul, and this was talking about the ninth step, but he said, Paul, try not to accumulate any more amends in sobriety than when you've gotten here. Now, I've been here 34 years. I've been sober 34 years. But what he said is so true for me and anyone I know with long-term sobriety. I was a raving, and sometimes still am, a raving madman in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, professing sobriety, still doing under-the-table money deals. Professing sobriety, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter because those seven deadly sins are going to be with me until the day I die. And so the program is about realizing that we're here, God forgives us no matter what we do, no matter what we've done, and we try to get better. And that's it. So if you're new and you're here for a while and you're doing something stupid, you know it's stupid. I know it's stupid. Certainly God knows it's stupid. Don't beat yourself up about it. Because like Fred T., my other sponsor, said, when the pain of the pain gets great enough, then the pain of the change will not be that difficult. And each of us has different tolerance levels for pain. Sober pain. I don't know what yours is. Sometimes I don't know what mine is. But I know when I get there. When I'm in that fetal position in my bedroom and I can't get to the door because of whatever it is I'm thinking or did or a combination of both, that's the time I better beg, cry, and reach out for every asset in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we all go through it. And when you're at that turning point sober, you either go or you grow. And that's what it is. I remember there was this old Ernie Martin tape from Montreal, Canada, 100 years ago. And his son died in sobriety. And he was very sober a very long time. And we were at a convention listening to him. And it was down here, actually. He was at the Breakers Hotel. And he said that he was real involved in the program. And this was such a devastating thing. I mean, look, any parent knows. I have my stepdaughter died. Any parent knows that potential tragedy. And he said, and he was now somewhat on the other side of it, and he said, and that was the time when I just had to go to the mountain alone. I never forgot that. There was no more talking to people. He had to just go commune with God and him to find out what this was. How could you possibly connect this thing? I'm a sober member of AA. I've helped 1 million people. How could a tragedy like this befall me? And, you know, so, and we don't understand those things, you know. So, anyway, that was the little piece I wanted to throw in, Russ. Is that right?
No, absolutely.
Were you listening?
Yeah, I was listening. I was doing my best.
You were researching.
Faced with this problem, if a doctor is honest with himself, he must sometimes feel his own inadequacy. Although he gives all that he has in him, it is often not enough. One feels, this book is so consistent. One feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. This is the doctor. He says, one feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. Like, what could he be talking about? The power of the rug? You know, we have this book. I think we read it before every meeting. You can't manage your own life. No human power could resolve this problem. Only God could and would if he was sought. Here it is right here. You might as well just like throw in chapter of the agnostic. One feels that something more than human power is needed to produce the essential psychic change. Though the aggregate of recoveries resulting from psychiatric effort is considerable, we physicians must admit that we have made little impression upon the problem as a whole. Many types do not respond to the ordinary psychological approach. I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. I have had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal which was to be settled on a certain date favorably to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to the date, and then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests, so that the important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. There are many situations which rise out of the phenomenon of craving which cause men to make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight. The classification of alcohol seems most difficult, and in much detail is outside the scope of this book. There are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. We are all familiar with this type. They're always going on the wagon for keeps. They are ever over remorseful and make many resolutions, but never a decision. I don't know how many people have worked with people in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, over a period of years. And, you know, I know you've worked with many people, and I have too. And I believe that there's always hope for people. But you ever worked with people that they just can't stay sober?
Ever have that happen? Many funerals.
It doesn't matter how many treatment programs they go to, and listen to this, and they're trying.
You bet.
And they're trying.
It's an anomaly.
It's amazing.
Right. I don't
know. You love them. You know, it's unbelievable. There is the type of man who is unwilling to admit that he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment. There is the type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger. There is the manic depressive type, who is perhaps the least understood by his friends and about whom a whole chapter could be written. Then there are types entirely normal in every respect, except the effect of alcohol, the effect alcohol has upon them. I've never met that type.
Have you ever met
the guy who's normal? Have you ever met that guy?
Not here. Not since I've been hanging out
with you. I haven't met that guy. An alcoholic, but utterly normal in every other respect. No. They are often able, intelligent, and friendly people. Oh, it must be me they're talking about. All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have is to suggest entire abstinence. And this is something that is interesting. I don't know, I guess this is really where they get into the idea of total abstinence from alcohol and other substances. And you've seen this to be a problem from some people. They say, well, I can't smoke marijuana or whatever. You know, you'll say, I can't do cocaine or marijuana, but I don't have any problem with drinking. I mean, this is just the problem with us, that we just cannot leave it alone. We can't leave it alone. You know, drinking is my problem, not dope. You know, drinking is my problem, not sleeping pills. You know, we cannot leave the idea alone that we just got to watch out for just about everything. We just can't accept that. And, you know, that was something I had to absolutely accept and understand. You want to say anything about that?
Well, I mean, it's just when you realize once again, I don't know, maybe I still get overwhelmed by the fact that this was written so long ago. And this last paragraph right here, the only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. This is Alcoholics Anonymous, big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. I didn't write this. I didn't invent it. By the grace of God, I've been able to follow it. It's right here. This is written down. And when he talks about we don't like rules, it's very funny. A person I got sober with, Phil V, who lives in Pittsburgh, and we said he has the same amount of time. Well, he has 40 days more than me, just like I have 11 months more than Russell. You know, similar thing. Phil never lets me forget it like this. And so we send each other a card every year, a congratulatory card. And at the end of summing up what's happened in this year, we both put, you know, we each to the other say, P.S., remember the rules are still the same. It's me and Phil, two degenerate, low-life, alcoholic heroin addicts from the 60s and 70s. Lives went to the crapper. We've both been blessed, gifted, and touched to be sober. And yet, because of what I talked about a minute ago, about always making those little sidetracks or switching seats on the Titanic, however you want to look at it, and the rules are still the same. What are the rules? You don't pick up one day at a time. You go to a meeting. You try to get a little more honest. You ask God to help. You try to help somebody else, and you thank God at night. Those are the rules. And if you do those rules, then the pain quotient will become less. Not that the pain will become less, and you'll still screw up, but your tolerance level will become less. And so you'll run for the answer rather than the exit. And that's what we want to hear. No matter how bad you think the shape you're in tonight is, so what? We've all been there. I promise you that. You're just another bozo on the bus. There's nothing that happened here that hasn't happened to someone else, that someone else hasn't done, and probably with a lot more class. So what I'm saying to you is just suck it up, stick here, talk to your sponsor, go to therapy, do something. Don't pick up, get to another meeting, help someone, and all will be well. When? I don't know. But it will be well.
I want to point out something.
I just want
you to know.
Please.
That it does not bother me at all, and I don't want you to think it does. Routinely pointing out that you have 11 more months than me. We're obviously different people. We're not exactly the same. We agree on a lot of things. Like, well, for instance, in 1976, you were certified as beat by the United States government as being mentally defective. You know, that's true. Now, that never happened to me. You know, so, you know, that may have been during that 11 months. For all I don't know, I'm not quite sure. It was prior to that time, but so we're obviously different in some respects. You know, I just want to point that out. It doesn't bother me at all.
The sad thing, and then I'll let you finish up, just for the people that don't
know. I'm not making that up.
No, no, you're right.
And the other fact is that certification was actually never rescinded. There isn't like a paper, you know, from the government saying, we're sorry, or that's no longer in effect, or any, you know. But, you know, you're entitled to your opinion. But, I mean, you know, these are just facts that we have to be honest about, you know.
Pastor, I'm not even going to retort. I'm going to sit back and accept it. I'm going to accept it. No longer the need to win the useless one. Carry on.
So, okay, should I? Okay. Let me see where it goes. Okay. This immediate precipitates us into a seething cauldron of debate. Ah, this is about the abstinence thing. By the way, wasn't there a group, and I forgot the name, maybe you remember the name, Moderation Anonymous, or what was it called?
Yeah, there was, I don't remember.
There was some group, I'm telling you, this is...
Moderate Drinkers Anonymous.
Or something that, it was...
One an hour,
something
one
moderate. It was a big group, and you know, they said, go away, forget alcohol, son, we'll teach you how to drink moderately, and this is a true story, and I wish I could remember the name of the group, Moderation or something, and the president of the group was arrested for vehicular homicide, because she was DUI and killed two people, you know?
Oh, yeah, I know.
You remember that?
She went the wrong way on a freeway, this was in California, right?
Yeah, she was the president of the group.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So apparently that moderation thing just doesn't work with alcoholics, you know? Yeah, this immediately precipitates us into a seething cauldron of debate. Much has been written, pro and con, but among physicians, the general opinion seems to be that the most chronic alcoholics are doomed. What is the solution? Perhaps I can best answer this by relating one of my experiences. Okay.
We're done.
This is the time that we now have a question. This is not a time for sharing. It's just questions. Any questions about what you gentlemen discussed this evening, now is the time to ask.
This happened last week.
Yeah.
And then someone raised a hand, and then there were 40 hands.
It was like the floodgate.
And we couldn't stop the question.
So
let's just go, yeah, little girl in the corner there with, who's that, Urban Cowboy next to you? Could you stand up, please? We can't.
Hi, I'm Kathy. I have a question. You guys are touching on complete absence, and maybe I misunderstood you correctly, but do you think that when they wrote the book and they said complete absence, they had in mind other substances, that they were aware that just alcohol or other substances could lead us back to our alcoholism, or?
Well, I don't know. I'm going to give you my opinion, which is all it's going to be, and then Russell will give you his. Yeah. And you see, I can't see you because the pamphlet's... Oh, that's what you look. Oh, you're not bad looking. Nice to see you. So, it says it in this whole thing. We did it last week and the week before and at different points in the book. It talks about drug addiction and drugs. My opinion, just my opinion, and I will certainly defer to Russell, is that Alcoholics Anonymous was, is, and always will be, this is my opinion, I don't know that it's written or not, a program of total abstinence from mood and mind-altering chemicals. Just my opinion, because my belief, not, it's an opinion and a belief, not in here that I know of, is very simply, if I'm taking a couple of Valiums to take the edge off, or smoking a reefer in the morning to get my day started, especially now when it's being legalized in Colorado or everywhere, there's going to be some issues, okay? I know for me, I am petrified about taking anything that's going to affect my mood or my mind. And so that's what I think they meant. I may be wrong. That's what was taught to me by the people who had what I wanted. That's what.
Let me answer it this way. Let's just look at this logically, okay? Because obviously the man's not here. I can't question him. These are people that worked in the field of alcoholism. These are people that were experts in the field of alcoholism. They have met all sorts of problems in alcoholism, drug addiction. There were drug addicts, alcoholics, both the same. They're dealing with these people, okay? They finally see something that looks like some sort of cure for alcoholism. They talk about total abstinence. Now, here's my first question. Let's forget about them. Do you believe it's true? Okay. Would I suggest that the reason you believe it's true is not because you've read it in the book, it's because you realize it's absolutely true. Based upon your experience. You've seen people who are alcoholics that go out and smoke marijuana, people who smoke marijuana go out and drink, and they can't stay sober, right? You've seen that happen. Well, let me ask them. If somebody went up to Dr. Silkworth, let's say in 19, you know, whatever, 36 or something like that, and said, you know, I stopped drinking. You think I can smoke this marijuana? What do you think Silkworth would have said? Yeah, I didn't mean abstinence from marijuana. I didn't see abstinence from cocaine. You can do that. You think you would have said that? Of course not. Because he had the same experience with these guys as you have, and you're out. He knows, unless they had a different form of alcoholism back then, unless alcoholism changed, if you were an alcoholic, you could smoke marijuana and get away with it, I guess maybe, but if it's the same disease, he must have noticed the thing that we notice now. So I assume he means abstinence from all mind-altering drugs.
You know what it is, Cassie, also? It's impossible to attempt to comfortably achieve contact and then maintain or get any form of conscious contact with anything or anybody if you're shit-faced on anything. So it's about, that's why it is about total absence. In my opinion, it's not even a talking point, but I was just being nice because I don't know these people. Yes, sir.
Like what she brought up, I believe the very original preamble, one of the requirements was complete abstinence because of what you said. That was being my impression that when I put alcohol, it is a power greater than myself, that was my higher power. And when I put it down to complete abstinence, I was able to go through that, clear my mind. So it was the original preamble, complete abstinence, right?
Thank you.
And it's written right here in the book.
We've gone through it for the last 3 weeks in different forms.
Right here. And the next thing in Bill's story, it says, here lies a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death drinking cold, small cold beer. A good soldier's near forgotten whether he died by musket or by pot. It's right there in the book.
I got it.
I'm not making this stuff up.
Who else has a question out here? Right in the back, way back. Kinsley, stand up, Kinsley. Hello. Can't see you, please stand up.
My name is Janet, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Janet.
It's just my opinion, but in the book it does talk about a case, XXVI, that more often than not is imperative that a man's brain be cleared before he is approached.
Ooh.
That he is better than, he has a better chance of understanding and accepting what we have to offer. And then it does say, I say this after many years of experience as a medical director, of one of the oldest hospitals in the country, treating alcoholism and drug addiction.
That was Taiwan.
Hey, let's talk about it from a different angle. This man, I assume, if they asked him to write these things, because they were going to put it in a book, if he's any type of professional, he'd say, I want to see the manuscript you're drafting. I don't want you to put my name in a book where I don't see what you're writing about, okay? So he probably had some sort of knowledge after speaking to people that's what in the book. The book does say something about the one thing you need is a constitutionally, you got to be honest with yourself. Isn't that true? You can't be unconstitutional. You got to be honest with yourself. So tell me about the honesty and the integrity that's involved when you're having a bad day or having a problem, and instead of dealing with it, you smoke a joint. Tell me how that has to do with being honest and integrity. Tell me about the integrity involved in not drinking, but using some sort of substance to overcome a problem instead of trying to deal with it in a sober way. What does that have to do with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? You know, it's the same deal. You know, you're either going to be honest with yourself and honest with your God and honest with what's going on, or you're going to try to escape from reality and make believe you're doing this when you're not. So, I mean, to me, the answer is sort of obvious.
Thank you, Cassie. We have time for one more question, perhaps, at 8:40. This, we're leaving after this week. We'll tell you where you can find us. But this is our last week here. So we're sorry to say. Our postings of where we'll be on Facebook. RussellSpatz.com. Any other questions?
We have any more questions. Okay. This group, that's all the time we have. This group is open for membership.